It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In this tax season, we check in with the State Department of Revenue a month out from the filing deadline for federal and state tax returns. Call in with a question. You can share your comments about tax filings and tax policies. Number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Peter Barka is Secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Revenue. Secretary Barka, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you very much, Kate, and terrific to be with you again.
Yes, well, here we are a month away from tax day. How do you expect the state's income tax collections to compare to previous years?
Well, we think they'll be very close to previous years. So far, it's been a very smooth tax season. We've already processed 1.2 million tax returns. We've had about a 3.9-day average for processing turnaround to try and get refunds back to people who have refunds coming due. The average refund has been a little over $800, $807.25 on average. So things are going well, although I always have to issue that cautionary note that the fraudsters are out there en masse. We've had two tax preparing groups who have been hacked already this year, and there are many more attempts that are out there. So I always like to at least advise people, keep your antivirus protections up to date and be very careful, for fraudsters and scams. So oftentimes people might get an email or a text claiming they're from the Department of Revenue or the IRS. And usually you can tell they're scammers because they'll say, you're in trouble, you owe money, there's a problem with your account. And people should know that, if there's something to be said, they'll get a letter, official letter in the mail. It won't come from a phone call or a text. We only call people if they've gotten a letter telling them to expect a call.
Are tax filing scams more of an issue this year than in years past?
Well, each year there seems to be an increase in the attempts that are being made. And they're getting more sophisticated about it as well, which is unfortunate. So we spend millions of dollars every year to protect taxpayers, to make sure that we're doing absolutely everything possible, and then to intercept those that are successful in hacking, tax preparation agencies. So we think we've been extremely effective at that. But again, we've got top tax professionals and contractors that help us to keep people safe. So that's why we like to at least warn people so that they are on alert.
I want to circle back to one of those one of the numbers you threw out there, 3.9 days to process returns. How quickly in general is a state aiming to process tax returns this year?
Yeah, that's our average, is 3.9 days on average. That includes paper, returns. Obviously, we encourage people to e-file because it's quicker, more efficient. Send in paper returns, that means we have to have those returns scanned, and we have to, check to make sure for illegible, kinds of markings so that we can, correct those, and there's more of a chance it'll be set aside, and we'll have to reach back out to make sure that it's been handled accurately. But on average, it's less than 4 days.
Are nearly all filings now electronic?
Yes, they are, Kate. It's really been remarkable. We now have, this year, for instance, over 96% are e-files, for individual returns. So that's extremely high, and, it's been creeping up year by year. It's a plus, really. We think it's safer, more secure, and there's less likely to have your taxes be held up because of, something illegible or maybe a decimal point in the wrong place, things of that sort.
Talking about tax season with Peter Barka, Revenue Department Secretary, you can join the conversation, call in with a question, share comments at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. So this year, the state is offering a new free filing system called WisTax. How is WisTax different from Wisconsin's previous e-filing system?
Well, it's much easier to use. It's easier to upload documents such as forms and other items that you need to include with your taxes. For some people, they can use their iPhone and file that way. So it's the platform that we use is much easier for people. And So that's why we've replaced the old, Wisconsin e-file with WisTax, and we've gotten very good feedback. And we've been testing it the last couple of years, and now it's our official way that people can file for free,
I wonder,
utilizing our system.
would WisTax find the same amount of savings and credits for the filer as buying a name brand, tax filing software?
Well, I would say that it's not really designed to find credits, but it certainly will list every single, line that, you can analyze to see whether or not you can have a deduction or a credit. But it's not really designed for that purpose. But I would say it's certainly just as easy to use as any other free filing tool that's out there. The other thing that's changed is we formed part of the IRS Free File Alliance. So in the past, tax software groups that wanted to participate wouldn't do it with states that already had their own free file. But the benefit of the Free File Alliance is you can file your federal and your state return at the same time, where our WisTax is strictly for state tax preparation, obviously. And we've got four different groups that are participating, and it seems like a large number of taxpayers are utilizing this new free software providing service, and that seems to be going very well additionally to the WisTax. So we're pleased to give people as many options as possible. Our goal is to make it easy for people to file and handle their responsibilities.
What do Wisconsinites filers have to know to access Free File?
Really, they can just go on our website and they can find the various options that are there. And once they open them, they're, very self-guided. So I know people have had good success with that.
And then, in the current budget, Governor Evers signed into law tax cuts that the Legislative Fiscal Bureau reports lowers income tax rates by roughly $3 a month per person. How do these cuts affect tax filing?
Well, really, they do not make tax filing any more difficult. It's just built into the system that, people obviously have to be aware of them, though. And, the newest one that he signed that'll take effect next year is a child care tax credit. So that will double the amount that you can claim. The governor in a previous budget was able to get 50% of the federal, and then this budget he asked for 100%, which didn't pass as part of a budget, but it passed as a separate bill. So it wouldn't be any different, as an example, when you go to file, except that when you look at what you're eligible for, you'll be able to put down double the amount compared to previous years, as of your filing next year.
And
So all that just to kind of make it clear that it doesn't make it any more difficult to take advantage of these credits for these tax breaks.
then circling around to the deadline, is a filer subject to penalties if they don't file their Wisconsin income tax return by the due date?
Yes, they are. And that's one thing I'm glad you brought up, Kate, because one thing we try to emphasize to people is that, I mean, you can file for an extension if you don't have all your information for some reason, but you do need to at least file by April 15th, and or file for an extension. And the other thing we try to encourage people is to file early. And I know for myself, to be frank, in past years, I would kind of wait till the end because I owed money. But the thing I've learned since joining the Department of Revenue is that you can file early and make your payment on April 15th. So that way you've already filed and you don't have any concerns about it being received on time. And then you can just make your payment as of April 15th. And what we found is that there's the fraudsters tend to attack people at the last minute. I don't know if they just think that we're not going to catch them because there's such a glut of people that file right at the end of the tax season, but generally it is safer to file earlier on in the tax season.
That is State Revenue Secretary Peter Barca with us in tax season to discuss developments in the financial position of our state with tax collections. Call in with a question. You can add your thoughts along the way at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. About two-thirds of the way through income tax filing season, give or take, we talk with Revenue Secretary Peter Barca about the activity in tax collections and the fiscal position of the state with the general fund surplus. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. So in January, the Legislative Fiscal Bureau said that lower than expected tax revenue would shrink the state's projected budget surplus by roughly $440 million. Why are surplus predictions lowering?
Well, there's a number of reasons why it's slightly lower. Obviously, in the first place, the governor has enacted new tax credits and new tax deductions as well. So that has an impact. And then secondly, there's been just a very slight slowdown in terms of the economy, the national economy overall. Actually, Wisconsin has been exceeding the national economy, but just a slight slowdown. It's actually a pretty small blip there that we've experienced.
The Fiscal Bureau's budget surplus prediction for the end of June of next year, how much money does the state have in its surplus right now? What can you tell us?
Well, we expect that we'll be right around $4 billion surplus at the end of this fiscal year. We feel like we're in very solid shape overall. And obviously, the state has made strategic investments as well as provided tax cuts, which puts us in a very strong position for attracting businesses from other states over the course of the last 20 to 30 years. And with governors of both parties, legislatures of both parties, there's been a steady move to make Wisconsin far more competitive. We're kind of in the middle of the pack in terms of, the tax obligation of state and local taxes. And if you add in fees, it's significantly lower yet because many states have much higher fees than Wisconsin does. So we're in a very strong position financially. Many people don't know, but for the first time in 40 years, we now have a AAA bond rating. In the last time we went to our bond rating agencies a couple of years ago, which I was thrilled to be part of for the first time, and Governor, of course, leading the team along with the Department of Administration and Department of Revenue, we saw that bond rating agencies view Wisconsin as being an extremely strong risk for investing money because our fiscal situation is so sound and we've been navigating things well. I know the governor has paid down debt as interest rates have gone up. So I think we're just in a very strong position fiscally and also competitively. We're in good shape.
But there have also been efforts to help stabilize the financial position of municipalities. And I just want to check in for a moment on shared revenue as we talk about, a strong fiscal position for the state. And with shared revenue, that increase in the amount of sales taxes going back to local governments, how is shared revenue affecting the state's finances, overall right now?
Well, thank you for bringing that up, Kate, because that was by far the most important bipartisan victory over the course of the last, legislative session for the last year and a half. The governor made it his number one priority. I was pleased that the legislature, both Democrats and Republicans alike, made it a priority as well. And, so there's two things that happened. One is for the first time in really virtually 20 years, we've had an increase in share revenue. But more important than that is what you suggested, Kate, is that for the first time, future share revenue will be tied to increases in sales tax so that, one-fifth of the sales tax will be dedicated to go back to local government. So they won't have to wait 20 years again to get an increase in share revenue because it'll be an automatic increase, provided the legislature or governor doesn't change it. And I believe at least certainly this governor and the current legislature is committed to that. So very important. You can't have a strong state without strong communities. And certainly that's why the governor made it his number one priority.
Let's talk about your January collections report showing corporate income taxes are down nearly 6% compared to last year. What is causing the decline in corporate income tax revenue?
Well, and actually, we just yesterday, this is very timely, we had a report from our economists, and it's gone back up slightly in February. So it is still down slightly, but not dramatically. And I think part of it is that, you know, corporate profits were up, you know, just at historic levels during the pandemic. As people had more money in their pocket, there was more spending, there was more production going on. I would say that it's, you know, just leveling off ever so slightly. So we're still in very strong shape, and, you know, we're kind of aligned with the national economy on corporate profits, since, you know, corporations, you know, in so many cases are across state lines. But really, it's been stable, and it's, you know, back up a little bit in February. So we're feeling pretty positive about, you know, corporate tax collections. And it really has gone up pretty dramatically. When I first started as Secretary of Revenue, income taxes, individual income taxes, made up more than 50% of the taxes collected. Now it's down to 46%, and it's almost completely because corporate tax collections went up pretty dramatically from, you know, somewhere around the neighborhood of 6% to above 10%. So they're at historic highs, and there's been a slight drop, but almost imperceptible.
In January, looked like a pretty big bump for a month if you compare that year over year, or, you know, month from the previous month, January in 2023. Is that pretty normal when there's a difference like that between the two revenue points?
Yes, it is. I mean, there's fluctuations that go on from month to month and quarter to quarter. So, you know, you do see those kind of, as you look at it like a curve on a line, you know, it's pretty steady if you look at it over, you know, three or four quarters, but from month to month, it can fluctuate. So it's you know, what we would expect to some degree.
We are talking about tax season with Peter Barca, Revenue Department Secretary. Call in with questions or comments at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. A little bit closer here on the economy in Wisconsin. We've been reporting here at WPR on a construction boom, setting record highs for construction jobs in January. How does a boom like that in the construction sector affect taxes or corporate taxes in particular?
Well, it certainly, you know, does have a positive impact. There's no question about it. And you know, there's a couple indicators that show that kind of positive movement. You know, that's certainly being very important. And we expect if the Feds do, in fact, lower interest rates as is expected, you know, in this late spring or early summer, that will only add to that. Secondly, the other thing for anybody that owns property, whether you're a homeowner or you own a business, equalized values in Wisconsin are sky high. They've hit record levels, showing, you know, the strength of investing here in Wisconsin. So we're very pleased to see those kind of positive economic indicators.
Circling back to scams for just a moment, you know, is there a proper way to report suspected tax fraud? So not a scam, but suspected tax fraud.
Well, certainly if you suspect fraud, and you know, we've had a very active task force at the Department of Revenue. Our Deputy Secretary, Maria Guerra-Lapasic, has led the efforts on that, along with DWD and the Department of Justice, because we know at times you have people that, you know, out-of-state construction companies, just as one example of what we see. They'll come into Wisconsin and set up shop, and they'll pay people in gift cards so they won't be paying their income taxes. They don't withhold for their staff. They're not paying unemployment or workers' comp. That's been one of our key priorities, is to catch these kind of out-of-state scammers. And, you know, there are, you know, fraud hotlines, and, you know, that they can call. There's certainly easy ways to report. And they can always call customer service, and, you know, if they need any kind of guidance. And if you don't mind, I'll share that number. It's area code 608-266-2486. But it's easy to Google. If you just Google Wisconsin DOR customer service that pops up right away. And one of the things we're very proud of is that we have a terrific staff. Our average hold time is normally about 90 seconds at the longest. And we ask people to take a survey when they're done. And we're just so proud of the fact we get 99% satisfaction ratings and rating our people as professional and knowledgeable. So they're there to serve you. And if you need help or you're suspicious about tax fraud in some way, or you think somebody has done you wrong, or you just need help, you want to understand.
There's someone on the other line there. Secretary Barca, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you, Kate. Appreciate the interest level, and thanks for keeping your listeners informed.
And Peter Barca, Secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Revenue. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We take a closer look at the priorities in President Joe Biden's budget proposal for the next fiscal year and requests to Congress. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a Madison business owner. It's part of a series we're airing this month on women in southern Wisconsin in partnership with Midwest Mujeres.
Have you ever been on a trip that changed the course of your life? Catalina Sanchez of Madison has. She told me about this as part of a storytelling project with Midwest Mujeres in Madison. Sanchez has always been interested in art. Her mother noticed this early on, so when Sanchez was in middle school, her mom sent her to New York City to spend time with a friend who created large spray paint murals.
We had like about 3 murals that we had to work on. So we were taking places that were kind of vandalized, not very welcoming, like, you know, offensive words, that kind of thing, and we were making it into something beautiful. And I just thought it was so inspiring that, you know, you can take whatever you have and always make it better.
Sanchez would carry that inspiration with her through the rest of her teenage years, which weren't always easy for her. She wrote about it in an essay.
Unfortunately, I haven't always been proud to identify as Latina. Growing up, my biological father, who was Latino, wasn't in the picture, and it made it hard for me to understand my culture and be proud of it. Growing up, I felt that I never fit in anywhere. I didn't fit in with the Latinos at school. I was too white because I didn't speak Spanish or understand it.
Eventually, Sanchez dropped out of high school.
I just wasn't myself. I wasn't doing anything. I'm just someone who always needs to be doing something and be proud of myself.
So she went to Madison College and got her GED. When plotting her next move, Sanchez would reflect back on that trip to New York and how happy she was creating art. So she enrolled in elite nail school. Now she specializes in nail art, creating these colorful, detailed sets on tiny personal canvases.
So it took me a little bit to get the hang of it, but it's just something that I'm very passionate about and I love doing. It makes me feel good, makes my clients feel good. It's, you know, a way for people to express themselves.
Sanchez got a job in a high-end salon, but it wasn't a great fit. So she took a risk and opened her own business, Graffiti Nail Salon. The name, inspired by that life-changing trip to New York.
When I was working for a salon, I thought people were coming there because of the atmosphere. It was a very, like, high-end luxury salon. So when I went off to my own place, it was just like an office suite. It wasn't even like a salon-style suite, but it made me feel very good to know that people are coming to me because of me, and they like my work, and they know that I take pride in what I do.
And her favorite part of the job?
And I will say for me, not only is like empowering them through their nails and like making people feel better about themselves, but I also get to meet a lot of different people from all different stages and walks of life. I meet young people, I meet like older people, like I meet so many different people, and they just teach me so many things about life.
A set of nails can take her hours, plenty of time to get to know her clients.
I actually do have a sign inside my salon that says, welcome to your therapy appointment, nail appointment. Yes,
Sanchez says her evolution from insecure teen to business owner has been empowering.
Because I just feel like my identity has been something that I've always kind of struggled with. Now that I'm a little bit older, I really do take pride in being Latina. I think it is just being around other people who are comfortable with themselves and, you know, being in your community of people who are like you. When you're around a lot of negativity and people who don't want to see you do good in life, you start to believe those things as well. So just like finding my place and like a good group of people to be around has really helped me.
Catalina Sanchez shared her story with us as part of a partnership with Midwest Mujeres in Madison. We've partnered with the organization to share stories of women who live in southern Wisconsin. After I talked with Sanchez, her business, Graffiti Nail Salon, experienced a devastating fire. Everyone was safe, but she lost everything. She told me via email, though, that she's not letting the tragedy stop her from pursuing her dreams. Sanchez's community has helped her with supplies and a workspace until she finds a permanent location once again. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. President Joe Biden's federal budget proposal for 2025 is a $7.3 trillion spending plan. We look at aspects of it, especially what could impact Wisconsin. And we explore your questions and comments. Call in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Chris Cox is Deputy Director of Federal Tax Policy for the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. That is a nonpartisan think tank. Chris, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much. Nice to be here.
Okay, so $7.3 trillion budget. What are your top line takeaways? What's unique about this budget?
Yeah, so this budget really takes a sound approach to key decisions that have to be made next year. So regardless of what happens in the elections this November, Congress is going to have to decide on key tax policies next year when the 2017 Trump tax cuts expire. And the president's budget proposes making the tax code fairer by increasing taxes on wealthy people and profitable corporations, and then investing in people, communities, and the economy.
So the president says his budget plan would cut the deficit by $3 trillion over the next decade with tax hikes on corporations and high-income earners. Billionaires would be required to pay a quarter of their income on taxes. What can you tell us about these taxes for wealthy people?
You know, currently, many wealthy people are able to shield their income from annual taxation. So while wage earners, you know, report their taxes each year and pay taxes on the wages that they earn, many wealthy people get the bulk of their income from capital income, from investments, and they pay very little or no tax on that income on an annual basis. And so what this budget does is it scales back these really inefficient tax breaks that are costly and really unfair, that allow the wealthiest households to continue to pay little to no tax on an annual basis.
President Biden said yesterday that no billionaire should pay a lower tax rate than a teacher or a sanitation worker, a nurse. Is that the case now?
You know, the budget increases taxes on wealthy individuals and corporations in a variety of different ways. Mm-hmm. You know, so there isn't one silver bullet that sort of makes the tax code more fair. But the budget chooses a variety of different tax policies that would do that. Again, under current law, there are special tax rates for capital income that are just not available to working people whose income primarily comes from wages. Mm-hmm. And the budget seeks to push back on that tax break. The budget also calls for extending funding for the IRS to improve taxpayer services and to go after wealthy people who are evading taxes and not paying what they owe. So there are a number of ways that the budget seeks to make the tax code more fair, particularly for wealthy people who often pay little or no tax on much of their income on an annual basis.
And so, as you say, this budget pushes back on those highest income earners. Would this budget make the federal government more reliant on a smaller subset, if you will, of taxpayers?
It's important when thinking about tax policy where the money sits. And what, under current law, again, so many people with high incomes, often their income is not taxed on an annual basis. So it is a sound and reasonable approach to increase taxes on wealthy individuals and corporations that often face, again, lower effective tax rates than working people, and have largely been able to avoid paying annual taxes or pay very little in comparison. The budget, you know, revenues are drawn from a broad base of people. So the budget proposes to make the tax code more fair by bringing kind of everyone into, more reasonably bringing everyone into paying the taxes that support the important investments that the federal government makes. And on that regard, it also asks high-income individuals and corporations who benefit from the investments that government makes in infrastructure and education to pay a fair share of tax.
The president also pledged to reject raising taxes on anyone earning less than $400,000 a year. And for 2021, the IRS reported that the top 5% of Wisconsin's earners had a median income of $218,000. And the Census Bureau reporting that median income of all earners in Wisconsin is just over $72,000. So what is significant about this, the president's pledge to not raise taxes on people who earn less than $400,000?
Yeah, this was a campaign pledge that we saw when the president was first elected, and that has continued. You know, what I think is again, really important is that the 2017 tax cuts were very skewed to the wealthy. They were very expensive, and they failed to deliver on the economic promises that their proponents had. And so one thing that's clear is when those tax cuts expire, what we should not be doing is extending tax cuts for people who are making above $400,000. We can have a discussion about whether that is the right line to draw. And for, you know, many people that seems like a very high income. At the same time, what's very clear is people making above that amount should not have their tax cuts extended.
Chris Cox focuses on federal tax policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities as we dig into aspects of President Biden's proposed federal budget for the next fiscal year. And you can call in with a question, share your comments at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Congress is still debating appropriations for the 2024 budget year, but the White House is looking ahead with its 2025 spending proposal. We explore the $7.3 trillion plan and potential effects on Wisconsin. Call in with a question. Share your comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have Chris Cox with us, Deputy Director of Federal Tax Policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Chris, is it unusual for an administration to propose a budget for 2025 when 2024 appropriations are still being hashed out by Congress? I mean, what do you make of those dynamics?
Yeah, this is such a tricky one this year, because we're seeing right now Congress in the midst of discussion for the spending bills for this current year. But this has been the congressional discussion has been delayed, and so it's important for the budget discussion to get started for the next year. The president's budget typically, in a normal year, would mark the start of a year-long process that culminates in Congress, passing legislation that would set the spending levels for the year. So it's right that Congress is quite busy with spending bills for this year and won't be able to kind of start on thinking about next year until it's done. And
It seems like the White House is sending the message like, you can still hash that out, but we're moving on here. We've got things that we want to set priorities for. What happens if no budget is approved by Congress and the president?
if spending bills are not approved for the coming year, then there are cases where we have seen government shutdown. Now, part of the spending bills have been continued, so this is something that's still very much in progress. But the president's budget is just the first step in this longer process, and we're right now seeing the current year's end of that process, where the House and the Senate have to agree on funding levels and send a bill to the president's desk to be signed. So we'll have to wait and see what happens with the current year spending bills, but that would be the that is the outcome that's needed to avoid a government shutdown.
Yeah, work in progress there. So the president in this budget proposal is calling for new spending on social programs, and I want to take a look at that. He called for making the child tax credit that was expanded as part of the American Rescue Plan, wants to make that permanent. How did this tax credit work?
The child tax credit supports families who have children, gives them money that helps them to buy groceries, pay for diapers, pay for childcare. And in 2021, it was temporarily expanded for just 1 year to be a larger credit and to reach families with children and families with low incomes, regardless of their income. And we saw this have wild success in 2021. It reduced this expansion of the child tax credit, reduced the number of children in poverty by more than 40%. I mean, just
Wow.
very striking evidence. And this president's budget proposes to continue that expansion for 2 additional years and to make some more minor changes on a permanent basis.
What other things stand out to you in the form of social programs in this budget proposal?
This budget invests in a variety of things that would, a variety of programs that would have meaningful impacts on people's lives. So just a couple examples, the nutrition assistance program for pregnant and postpartum parents and young children, WIC, Women, Infant, and Children, it funds that. It reduces the cost of prescription drugs and expands health coverage. The budget reduces housing costs and proposes a national paid leave program and many more things.
We are talking with Chris Cox, Deputy Director of Federal Tax Policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, and taking a deeper dive in the proposed federal budget for 2025. You can join in along the way, questions and comments, 800-642-1234. So, President Biden visited Milwaukee this week, highlighting this budget proposal, including $3.3 billion for infrastructure spending in dozens of cities to help rectify damages that communities of color saw from redlining and from urban renewal projects.
These investments advance my Justice 40 initiative to deliver at least 40% of all the benefits from clean transit, clean energy, and climate investment to disadvantaged communities. That's a commitment I made and we're keeping. Here in Milwaukee will mean $36 million in new federal funding to rebuild Sixth Street.
So, what would Biden's budget plan mean for cities in Wisconsin like Milwaukee?
My focus is really on the federal level, and there would be experts who could speak speak to what the budget would do for Milwaukee and for specific cities. On the previous point that we were talking to about the child tax credit proposal and its expansion, that would reach an estimated 630,000 families in Wisconsin who would benefit from that. So there are ways that the budget reaches in and supports supports families in Wisconsin.
Republican leaders in the House called the president's budget proposal, quote, a roadmap to accelerate America's decline. What could happen to the budget and this vision from here?
Because the president's budget is sort of a first step to a year-long budget process, you know, it is the starting document that says, these are the priorities of the administration. This is how they believe they should invest in people, in communities. With Republicans in control of the House of Representatives, this budget will not pass as is. Just like normal process, the House and Senate will go back and forth, and then ultimately will have to agree on funding levels that they would then send to be signed into law by the president.
The budget calls for a 2% federal employee pay raise. And according to the Federal News Network, it's well below what some House and Senate Democrats are calling for next year. What do you make of this pay raise proposal? Is it in line with the rest of the budget?
I can't speak to the pay raise specifically, but again, the budget makes some sound investments in people and communities, and again, sets out spending levels for all of the areas that the federal government is involved in. So it is really a massive document that seeks to set priorities in just a wide swath of areas that touch people's lives.
Let's go to Sherry now. Sherry, hi, go ahead.
Hello.
Hi, Sherry. What is on your mind?
Hi, I really appreciate this conversation that's occurring. I just have a question for your guest. I feel that you, the host, have asked some wonderful questions about how the budget cuts for the wealthy are going to help them evade taxes. However, I felt like you've tried to ask some questions to give more specific answers as to how, other than that specific role that she's saying is going to benefit the rest of us. I understand that money is.
I have to jump in here, Sherry, and cut Chris very quickly. What would people who are not billionaires benefit from in this budget?
Speaking again about the child tax credit, this is something that would deliver broad-based benefits to families. Roughly 65 million children across the country would see benefits from this, and an estimated 630,000 families in Wisconsin would see their child tax credit go up from the proposal in the president's budget. That's just one of many examples.
Thank you for joining us. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about sheep shearing ahead of lambs being born in the spring, and you can be part of the discussion about the industry around shorn wool. Call in with a question, share your comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Now to a family farm in Wisconsin where the craft of sheep shearing is passed from one generation to the next. Mackenzie Crummy reports.
Jerome Huber remembers the first time he sheared a sheep.
My first job out was 9 head for the neighbor and took me all afternoon.
Huber was 15 years old. Since he was too young for a driver's license, he had to get rides back and forth to jobs across south central Wisconsin. Today, Huber can shear the same number of sheep in less than 30 minutes. But while his skills have improved over the past 70 years, the demand for workers like him is much higher these days. Fewer people are becoming professional shearers in Wisconsin, where about 78,000 sheep and lambs live. Huber and his family are now rare specialists in the state's farming industry. Huber's sons and grandsons started shearing as teenagers like him. His adult son, Joe, has been shearing for 43 years.
I would say they're one of the probably the longest lasting or been in the business for as long as anybody in the state. As other shearers come and go, that family's been doing it for a long time.
That's Todd Taylor, a manager of the Sheep Research Unit for the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Taylor says the need for shearers is at an all-time high across the country.
There is a technique to it. It's not just lay a sheep down and start shearing. You know, there is a proper way to do it so that you can efficiently and safely get the wool off in one piece. You don't do any harm to the sheep.
At the Huber family farm in Oxford, several barns are filled with sheep, cattle, and equipment. The farmhouse has been in the family for generations. Jerome Huber was born in the bedroom where he sleeps today. In one barn, Joe Huber preps the family's shearing equipment as the sheep wait nearby.
These are our hand pieces that we shear with. We have different hand pieces. We have a quarter horse motor with a drop shaft to run the machines, and then we just plug our hand pieces into them.
The job requires a crew of people. A wrangler plucks sheep from the herd. A wool handler gathers and rolls the wool. The wool comes off the sheep in a single piece and weighs on average 5 to 15 pounds. Huber's son Joe is explaining the operation.
Breaking up through the neck. So this position here is the hardest position to learn how to hold the sheep. You know, he just went up through the blind where he doesn't see his blade at all.
The Hubers and Taylors say sheep must be sheared. Less wool helps sheep deliver lambs in a more sanitary condition and makes it easier for lambs to feed from their mothers. The decline in professional sheep shears is partially driven by the difficulty of the job. According to the Hubers and Taylor, the work is physical and tough on the body. The Hubers sometimes leave jobs with bruises from being kicked by sheep. One grandson even blew out his knee. Today, Wisconsin is home to fewer wool-producing sheep than past decades. The U.S. Department of Agriculture says Wisconsin created nearly 590,000 pounds of wool in 1997. Last year, about 45% less wool came out of the state. Here's Jerome Huber.
Well, it's a generation now. Everybody's going to polyester clothes and everything, cotton. And wool costs a lot more for processing, and it costs the consumer more. But wool lasts so much longer.
Sheep shearing requires training and practice to become efficient. Taylor says the Hubers are masters of the trade. In February, Joe Huber traveled to shear a herd of 400 sheep with his two sons. They completed the job in 2 days, averaging 15 sheep an hour. Joe Huber won a national championship for sheep shearing in 1988. He now teaches an annual class for beginners in Arlington. He says the work should focus on quality, however, not speed.
Here in Wisconsin, what my dad taught me and I taught my sons and what I teach at shearing school, speed is not everything. Do a good job, and you don't want to nick them up, because a lot of sheep in Wisconsin are people's pets, and they don't. If you nick them up and cut them up or rough with them, you won't be back to shear their flock next year.
Joe Huber and Todd Taylor plan to teach the class again at the end of the year. Huber says 16 students typically sign up and maybe one or two go on to become shearers. But at the family barn on a recent Saturday, relatives and friends show up to watch the Hubers shear 90 head of sheep. It's like a party. Jerome Huber's great-grandkids are here, too.
How about you, dear? How old are you?
5.
You're 5? Are you going to shear sheep? Are you?
The boy nods, drawing a smile from Jerome Huber.
I'm kind of proud about it. So... Never thought it would be a business like this.
Mackenzie Crummy, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now we continue to explore the industry around Wisconsin-raised sheep and lambs with Heather Pierce, Wool Production Program Manager for the American Sheep Industry Association. You can call in with a question, share your thoughts at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Heather, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So we just heard up close and personal there one Wisconsin family's experiences in the industry. Can you explain what happens to wool after the fiber is removed by the shearers?
Sure. So they mentioned how after it's shorn, somebody takes that and handles the wool. So they take it over to a table oftentimes and take off some of the not so valuable parts of the wool. So maybe some of the shorter pieces or the really dirty pieces. And then that wool gets packaged. And then all of that wool is still raw wool. So it has lanolin in it and hay pieces and dirt. And so it needs to be processed. And that way it can make its way into a sweater or shirt or scarf, something like that. So it'll usually make its way to somewhere like a warehouse or wool pool that gathers more wool. And then it makes its way to a wool buyer. And that buyer will, again, gather more wool from different places. And so it has a larger load and then sell it to a processor. And so, like I said, that wool is still really dirty and it has all the lanolin in it. So it has to be washed. So that's the first stage in the processing is being washed. And so the lanolin is really important. It'll be separated off and it goes into cosmetics and lotions. And then the wool is dried. And at that point, it's kind of a mess. It's all not tangled, but it's just kind of a big mess. And so it has to be combed out and all those fibers going in the same direction.
And that's how you card the wool.
So carded and combed out. Yep. And then it'll be spun into yarn. And then we need some way to get it actually into clothing from there. So it needs to go into fabric. And there's really two kind of main ways to get into fabric. And one of them is knitted. And so you can think of like a t-shirt that's knit and it's stretchier. And then all the other way is woven. And so that's a little bit more structured type of fabric. After that, that fabric will be cut and then sewn into the final product.
Is the price that farmers receive for wool different today compared to past decades? What is the marketplace like?
Yeah, so it's pretty rough right now. So wool is definitely a global commodity. It's grown and sold all over the world and processed all over the world. And you probably think of big wool places like Australia, and you would be right. Australia produces the most pounds of clean wool. And so really Australia prices set the foundation for our prices here in the U.S. And in especially the 2018 and a little bit before that, prices were really good. Wool was having a great price time. But then after that, especially here in the U.S., we entered the U.S.-China trade war. And so we started seeing prices go down. And then COVID hit and everything stopped. So processing all over the world stopped. But sheep don't start up growing wool. It just keeps growing just like your hair does. And so with that, we've really seen an oversupply of wool now, and we're still working through that oversupply.
There was one major buyer near Wisconsin, the Mid-States Wool Growers Cooperative, that was in Ohio, closed last year. How does the closing like a co-op like that affect the wool market for Midwest farmers?
And so part of it is that transportation is expensive. Just like for anything. And so when there's not a buyer in an area, it does make it more expensive and it's harder to find a buyer. So it's more expensive to transport it to them and it's harder to find a buyer. Luckily, there is still one not too far over the border in Illinois from Wisconsin, and that's Grunwald Fur and Wool. And they take, they're actually pretty unique. They work directly with shearers. And they'll, so the shearer goes out, shears somebody's sheep, and they'll actually pay them for their wool right then and there. And then the shearer takes the wool and takes it to Grunwald. And then that way they can gather more wool and market it.
Heather Pierce with us, the American Sheep Industry Association's Wool Production Program Manager, as we discuss the industry around shorn wool in Wisconsin. You can be part of the discussion. Call in with a question, share perspective, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. As springtime is a typical season for shearing sheep, we explore aspects of production and the larger industry in Wisconsin as fleece moves through a process and becomes a clothing garment or another item using wool. Call in with a question. You can add comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. We have Heather Pierce with us, Wool Production Program Manager at the American Sheep Industry Association. Heather, you mentioned Australia kind of setting global market prices. The International Wool Textile Organization says Australia is the largest clean wool producing country, China being the largest greasy wool producing country. What is the distinction there between clean and greasy wool?
Yeah, so right, it's kind of surprising. You don't always think of China as having that many sheep. And so when we talk about wool, we usually sell it on a clean basis. So that's after it's been washed and that lanolin and dirt has all come out. And so Australia produces the most clean wool, then, so actually pounds of wool that has already been cleaned. And then China, it fluctuates year by year, but China produces a lot of wool in general. So, but when it's not washed, if you're looking at it on that basis, they produce sometimes more than even Australia.
And so wool that is not washed or sanitized in any way, that would be considered greasy wool?
Yeah, so all wool comes off greasy. It's raw wool right off the sheep. And then after that, it'll be cleaned. And so you can think about it that raw greasy wool is a certain amount of weight. And then after you wash it, it'll lose roughly half of its weight.
So why has China become a leading exporter of wool in the past decade?
Yeah, so they produce a lot of wool. And part of it is that most of the processing in the world happens in China. And so they take their wool right from their own country and can process it. And then they also use a lot of that wool. So they are a very heavy user of wool products.
Let's take a call. Jerry in Kakana is here. Jerry, hi.
Yes. Can you talk about the differences between the alpaca and llama wool and how it compares to merino? And is there a difference in microns?
Jerry, thank you. Can you talk about those differences and specifically alpaca?
Sure. So alpaca is also a beautiful fiber. It doesn't have the lanolin that wool does. And so in terms of processing, it's maybe a little bit easier for small mills to process that fiber. Alpaca doesn't also always have the crimp that some wool has. So some wool is probably more crimpy than alpaca has, and that crimp really gives it more elasticity in a product and memory. And then in terms of microns, so when we're talking about that, all wool, whether it's alpaca or wool from sheep or alpacas, the fibers are measured in terms of microns. So that's actually how wide the individual fibers are. And alpaca tends to be fairly fine. A wool has a really broad range. So if we're talking about merino, it can be down into the teens, up to about 21, 22 microns. But then wool also goes up all the way into the 30 microns. And just for reference, human hair, say, is from usually about 50 to 100 microns. So definitely a lot coarser for human hair. But merino is fairly comparable to the alpaca in terms of micron.
Okay, so Jerry, thank you for that question. Later, we're going to talk to Windridge Fiber Farm, where the farmer creates fiber from wool, sells it locally as yarn and other products. How common are hyper-local markets in the country?
Yeah, so even when I was growing up, there were definitely some around, some of those niche markets that sell yarn to hand spinners and other fiber artists. And since COVID, it's actually grown even more. So people stayed home and they learned how to knit. And so that market has grown even more since then.
We heard in the piece that, you know, there is an art to sheep shearing, and there's certainly a lot of mastery in the work so you as not to nick the animal or to cause pain. Is there any way for consumers to know if the fleece that eventually makes its way into clothing is harvested humanely?
So I would say on the very, very large, most everybody. They're around sheep every day. They care about sheep. And a farmer certainly doesn't want to see their animals being hurt. Nobody wants to see anything like that. So people take a lot of time and effort to learn how to shear properly. And they go to schools all over the U.S., like we talked about, to learn how to do that. So it's a profession, and they have training in that. And so people take a lot of care and a lot of pride in how they shear their sheep here.
Some industries, you know, see worker shortages, like healthcare. Is this particular very niche type of industry seeing a new generation of people who want to learn the art and mastery of shearing sheep?
Yeah, so there is definitely a shortage of shears here in the U.S. and even globally. But we are starting to see, there's always people here and there that are interested. Sometimes it's family members that that's what their family does, and that's great. And other times, there's certain places that maybe your friend does it, and so you tag along, and then you start to learn. Mm-hmm. And so it's somewhat random, but great that there you have the traditional sources and then new ones as well.
We have Heather Pierce with us from the American Sheep Industry Association as we talk about fleece that turns to wool and in the products that we use. Call in questions and comments about the process, 800-642-1234. Allison in Racine is here. Hi, Allison. Go ahead.
Hi, I was wondering how Italy factors into the wool market. I know they're renowned for textiles, and it's a historically an important industry in that country, and I'm just wondering how wool might fit in there.
Thanks, Allison. Yeah, what is the place of Italy and their wool, Heather?
So, absolutely. They definitely create very high quality, high end wool products still. And they have processing there. And so that is a very important place for wool to go when you're thinking about those high end markets. And that ranges from the traditional high end brands that you might think of to more of the even hand knitting end as well.
You are noticing that wool pellets for gardening are gaining traction, gaining popularity. What do you see there with wool used in gardening?
Yes, so that one has really taken off lately. And so it's wool pellets are just raw wool, so still has that lanolin and everything in it, and it's compressed into a pellet. And then you can put that in with your garden and pots, plants. And the neat thing about that is that wool helps hold water. So it will hold water down in that soil. And then at the same time, that lanolin helps feed the plants. And then as the wool fibers actually biodegrade back into the soil, they also fertilize the plants. So it's a pretty neat process there. And then I said that it was mostly garden, but they're also starting to do trials even for crops.
And what would happen with crops, more of a widespread approach to using wool in crops?
Yeah, so still doing it as pellets right now. Mm-hmm. I think it's probably the easiest way to get it down into the soil. And so right now, one of the first trials it sounds like they're going to do is on potatoes. And so really doing it on a larger scale.
Okay, and perhaps even keeping moisture in the farmland, maybe it would reduce runoff. Heather, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Heather Pierce, Production Program Manager at the American Sheep Industry Association, and we continue this conversation about sheep wool fiber and its uses. You can call in with a question. Share your comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We learn about sheep, wool, and fiber arts in Wisconsin and the shearing, the spinning, the weaving processes to make clothing and other items with wool. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Martha Bush is here, textile artist teaching classes in the Driftless area in Wisconsin and Minnesota. Martha, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be here.
And Tammy Bowser is here as well, owner of Windridge Fiber Farm in Hollandale with a flock of about 60 ewes and more during lambing season. Tammy, welcome.
Hello. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, Tammy, let's start with you. You've been raising sheep for about two decades now. Why did you get into this niche business?
Well, it started with, I was at a garage sale and bought a floor loom for weaving, and I had no idea what I was doing. So I took a class, and then I thought, gee, I could produce my own wool for weaving, and it just kind of took off from there. And then I learned to spin, and it's kind of a rabbit hole.
It sounds like it spiraled, just like a growing ball of yarn, maybe.
Exactly.
Martha, you teach and you've been working with textiles, you know, for decades now. What is unique about working with wool as a textile?
I love felting wool, although I do lots of other things with wool too, but felting I think is my favorite because it is so plastic. It's so flexible. You can do so very many things with it. It's just a wonderful fiber material.
Very many things. Like what? Can you tell us about your works?
Well, I teach, and I'm a Waldorf teacher, and we use a lot of natural fibers. And so I make most of the puppets that I work with my parent-child classes out of wool. So I'm felting, you know, the Three Little Pigs or the Billy Goat's Gruff, or I'm doing There Was an Old Man with a Beard here this next week. And I make those puppets out of wool. Typically, I do needle felting, but sometimes they're also water felted, and I can elaborate on those processes if you're interested.
Yes, water felting. Help us understand what that is.
So I think that wool is one of the oldest, well, felting is one of the oldest textiles, and my theory is that some early person was walking along and was getting a blister in their shoe and saw a nice fluff of wool on a thorn and said, ooh, I'm going to put that in that sore spot. And when they got to their destination and took their shoes off by the fire, they looked down and that fluffy thing that they had plucked off the thorn was now really different. And it was squished together and had become a matted together piece of cloth. And that is the process of water felting. It's a chemical process where the little platelets of the fiber open up under heat and moisture, and then agitation, in this case, walking along with that little fluff in your shoe, causes the fibers to enmesh. And in the process that we do now, you would typically then rinse off the fiber, and that's going to close up those little platelets and cause everything to connect. So it's, you know, most people can relate to dreadlocks. Mm-hmm. Dreadlocks are basically felted. And that's the same basic thing that happens with animal wool as well. And then there's needle felting, which is the mechanical process where you use a needle. And they use thousands of these needles in producing commercial felt. I think most people are familiar with this from school projects or Halloween costumes or something, that there are these thin, flat pieces of felt, and these days mostly made out of acrylic, but I prefer, obviously, wool felt. But the machine will put these needles, thousands and thousands of them all lined up, down through the fiber to enmesh them. Each needle has these tiny little barbs on it, and they grasp a hold of the fibers and stick them through each other until it is basically all matted together. And that is the process that creates felt mechanically on an industrial level, but as artists, we use those individual needles and they come in different gauges or thicknesses, and sometimes they have different shapes, and that allows the wool to be felted together. But artistically, I love being able to use needles in felting because I can make very elaborate shapes. I can add different colors. I can build up large quantities and make something very sculptural.
Yeah, let the creativity run wild. Well, thank you so much for taking us through that process. You know, Tammy, why do you prefer to work with wool? What is the draw for you?
Well, I think, you know, kind of the same. It's very versatile. There are so many different fiber arts that wool can apply to, and wool blends too with other materials such as silk and other like alpaca and fibers. So it's just that I guess that ability to create so many different things with one item.
Mm-hmm. Well, Tammy, Sylvia emailed to ask about the wool conservation program, Shave 'em to Save 'em. That's the name of the program. Do you have any insights on what this program does?
I do. It's I'm part of that program. It's a program that the Livestock Conservancy runs, and the kind of the drive behind the program is there are lots of sheep breeds, and there are a lot of them that, because they haven't fit into the commercial molds, have kind of fallen by the wayside, and I'm sure we've lost many breeds, but there are people out there trying to conserve some of the heritage breeds. And in fact, I have Cotswolds, which are a threatened breed. And so their program, Shave 'em to Save 'em, is you get a passport book with different breeds in it, and each producer has stamps that if you purchase 4 ounces of wool from one of the breeds listed, then you get a stamp to fill your passport book, and then they have little prizes when you fill the passport book. So it's just a way to encourage people to try the different heritage breeds.
We're talking about wool with artists and entrepreneurs. That is Tammy Bowser. We have Martha Bush here. You can join in questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. I want to talk a little bit more about the Cotswold, the breed that you have on your farm. Can you describe what they look like? I mean, this is a very large sheep from what I understand.
They are a larger breed, and they're considered a long wool breed, where in the sheep breeds you have finer wools, which would be like the merinos, and then there are some that kind of fall in between, and finer being the crimp of the wool. Like merino has a very crimpy wool. The Cotswolds, being a long wool, they can grow up to 12 inches of wool in a year. And the crimp is very open. It's kind of more like, really like a person's that has curly hair, kind of more like that. And generally they're white. There are a few black Cotswolds, and they have, as you can imagine, with, 6 to 12 inches of wool on them, they're very woolly, and it hangs down in kind of ringlets, and they have wool on their face, so it looks like they have long bangs. So they're a very pretty sheep.
Let's take a call now. Brian joining us from Fort Atkinson. Brian, hello.
Hello. I was calling because I remember when I was a kid, I had to have some surgery on my left foot. And they had used some or given me some wool, and I had a wood-like shoe or thing that I was using for a shoe because of the surgery. But then they said like a piece of wool would make that a lot easier to walk with and stuff. Mm.
So wool, trying not to rub at the surgical site. Martha, it seems like a little bit about the story you told.
Yeah, it is a little bit like that. And that reminds me of, I'm of Potawatomi ancestry. And so I have wool inside my moccasins for a cushion. So it does definitely provide that softness and a little bit of layer of protection. Wool is an amazing fiber. It's very absorbent, you know, it keeps you warm even when it's wet. It's pretty amazing.
Is wool itchy? Some people complain about it being itchy. What are your thoughts on that, Martha?
Well, I think it has a lot to do with what Tammy was talking about. Sometimes people look for merino wool because it is a thinner fiber. And when you have longer fibers, the little pokey ends don't itch so much. So that can be a part of what makes wearing wool against the skin more comfortable. And also getting blends, like again Tammy mentioned, maybe blending with silk, that can make things a lot softer if you're talking about a knitted garment, for example, or something like that. And the process of making yarn helps to draw those fibers along the length, and so that makes it less itchy.
Yeah. In drawing those fibers along, is spinning a difficult process for you?
I'm a terrible spinner. I have tried drop spindle spinning, and I'm really not very good at it. My daughter is a wonderful fiber artist in her own right. She is a knitter and makes all sorts of amazing things, but she is also a very capable spinner, and I've tried it, and I should really stick to felting because I am a terrible spinner.
Tammy, do you have any tips?
Yeah, I teach spinning classes. So really what I always tell people when they're first starting is get the wheel and just sit and treadle. So just use your foot, because you're trying to do two things at once when you're and your muscle memory isn't there yet. It's like, rubbing your belly and patting your head when you're trying to make the wheel go in the right direction and trying to feed the wool in to put the twist in it. So it's good to start with one part of it first and kind of get that down before you move on to the next step. But once you've got it, it's very relaxing. And the great thing about it is, because there are so many different breeds of sheep, if you go to the store to buy yarn, you're probably getting, in most cases, a merino or a superwash merino, where they've remove the scales from the fiber to make it softer. But there are so many other possibilities. And when you can spin your own, you can be very creative.
Tammy Bowser is owner of Windridge Fiber Farm in Iowa County. Martha Bush with us, textile artist in the Driftless region, teaching in Southwest Wisconsin. And as we discuss wool fiber, call in with a question. You can share your thoughts, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about the wool and fiber arts community in southwestern Wisconsin and the processes of shearing sheep and carding the wool, spinning it into yarn, weaving with it. Be part of the discussion. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Martha Bush is with us, textile artist, teaching classes in the Driftless area. Tammy Bowser, owner of Windridge Fiber Farm, also in southwestern Wisconsin. Tammy, I want to take a moment to kind of learn about your flock. Like, what are the personalities of your ewes? Do you know them kind of personally?
Yes, I know them personally, and they all have names. So, and it is a wide variety of personalities. I have some sheep, such as Sweet Pea, who just would be very happy to curl up in your lap if you would let her and be scratched. And then there are others that are a little less interested in the hands-on unless you've got a grain bucket in your hand, and then you're a very popular person.
Do they get into mischief?
Yes, they can, particularly when their shepherd forgets to maybe hook a gate or something, and then they like to roam and, you know, check things out. So,
have you found any attachment to certain sheep, as the time goes on with them, learning more about their nuances?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I mentioned Sweet Pea because she's one of my, she was a bottle lamb back in the day. And so they tend to be much, much friendlier. And she's, she probably spent the first week of her house or of her life living in our house. So she's
inside the house,
kind of like the family dog.
Oh my goodness.
Pardon me?
Inside the house, roaming around in those first weeks of life?
Yes. Yes. We often during lambing time, if we have a bottle lamb, I have some totes and they need to be fed their bottles pretty frequently. And that's 24 hours a day. So rather than kind of being the lazy person and not feeling like going outside to give a bottle every couple hours during the night, they live in our mudroom in a tote and then they have easy access.
What is lambing season like? How busy is it?
It can be really crazy. I think this year it should be pretty nice because we have wonderful weather. And actually just any moment now I could have my first lamb. Today is kind of the first due date. So, sometimes it's pretty laid back and you have a lamb here and there. And then there are other times when they all decide that now would be a really good time. And you're trying to figure out which lamb belongs to which mom. And yeah, so it can kind of be a little bit of both crazy and laid back.
We heard from Anne in Appleton, sent along an email wondering, they have a lovely sheepskin that's become a bit matted. How do they care for it? They started to brush it, but it was getting frizzy and was losing some hair. Martha, any tips?
You know, that is a little bit complicated because you can pull out the hair if you're not careful. I have a lot of carding combs. I actually even do carding with toddlers. You can use the pet brushes that you can get that have an angled little comb to it. And if you are gentle, you can pull that. But I would maybe recommend for the sheepskin to use one of the wool wash products. They often have them with some of the lanolin in them that can clean the fleece without it becoming matted or felted. Mm-hmm. And that usually requires some soaking, but you also have to consider the skin itself on the back end. I don't know, Tammy might have some good recommendations on this too.
What do you think, Tammy?
Well, I know that some processors have create washable pelts and others do not. So I think part of it would be figuring out whether it is a washable pelt. And if so, I would definitely say using one of the wool washes and even like some conditioner would probably be helpful. But if it's not, I don't know, that could also wreck it. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of hard to say.
Okay. Well, Tammy, you sell locks of wool that are hand dyed, Concord grape and forest floor colors. What are tips for dyeing wool at home?
I would say the first thing is safety. So you do want to wear a mask when you're using the powdered dyes, because you certainly don't want those in your lungs. But other than that, it's just, it's even mistakes can be fun mistakes. I sometimes have colors that just didn't quite go the way I had planned and they turn out to be, just wonderful new colors. So, having your dyeing area, you don't want to use, if you're using commercial dyes anyway, you don't want to use just your regular pots and pans. You want to have items that are specifically for dyeing. But you can even get into it starting with things like Kool-Aid, and then that's perfectly safe. And that's something that you know, children can do as well. So all those food coloring dyes can also make some really interesting colors.
Oh, kiddos could probably use the Kool-Aid. Martha, do you have any preferences for dyeing wool?
Actually, I was nodding along as Tammy was speaking. I tend to use the very accessible Kool-Aids and food colorings because protein fibers like wool, like silk, require an acid dye bath to dye properly. And vinegar can be that. And you can also use a microwave or your stovetop if you're using food-grade dyes like food coloring and Kool-Aid. And just, you know, have a very successful time dyeing wool. I've also done it in the sun, in jars, and with vinegar and the coloration. I tend to use a very high saturation of food coloring or Kool-Aid, and then I think it's a 3-to-1 acid to water ratio. But yeah, I've had a lot of success. I do that in a number of classes.
Oh, well, this has been so much fun. Thank you both for joining us.
My pleasure. It's been great.
Oh, dear. That is Martha Bush, textile artist, teaching classes in the Deerfield area in Wisconsin and Minnesota. Tammy Bowser, owner of Windridge Fiber Farm in Hollandale, with those lambs on the way. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.